Greetings and welcome to the Beacon Broadcast from Beacon Baptist Church on Kirkpatrick Road in Burlington, North Carolina. The Beacon Broadcast is supported in part by the gifts of faithful listeners. If you'd like to correspond with Pastor Barkman and the Beacon Broadcast, or if you wish to support this radio ministry, write to the Beacon Broadcast, Post Office Box 159, Alamance, North Carolina, 27201. The Beacon Broadcast, Post Office Box 159, Alamance, North Carolina, 27201. Now with today's message from God's Word, here is Pastor Greg Barkman.
We are spending extended time in Romans chapter 14 because I'm convinced it is one of the most important chapters in all the Bible and one of the most neglected. And it contains some truths that so many of God's people have just never really considered, perhaps have never even seen, that it's very important that we go into this in a great deal of detail. And that's exactly what we're doing. Now, we have noticed that Paul puts Christians into two broad categories, the category of Christian liberty and the category of non-Christian liberty. That's not really the way he puts it here. He calls them strong brothers and weak brothers, those who are strong in the faith, those who are weak in the faith. We could call them, and we have been calling them, strict believers and non-strict believers. The non-strict ones are the ones who are stronger in faith and whose faith allows them to do whatever the Bible allows. And then on the other hand, the strict believer whose conscience will not allow him to do some things that the Bible does allow. He will not allow him to go to the limits of biblical liberty to explore all of the things that the Bible allows and considers to be non-essential, but instead he restricts himself because of culture and tradition and background and a conscience which has not been properly and fully developed along biblical lines. Now here's the way Paul puts it in the first three verses of Romans chapter 14, and I go back to that again so that we can orient ourselves in what Paul has laid out as these two categories of believers. And so he says in verse 1, receive one who is weak in the faith. You see, that's one category, weak in the faith. This is the strict believer, overly strict. Receive one who is weak in the faith, but not to disputes over doubtful things. For, verse 2, one believes he may eat all things. That's the Christian liberty believer, the non-strict believer, whose faith allows him to eat anything and everything. But he who is weak, verse 2 goes on to say, eats only vegetables. That's the weaker brother, the stricter brother, who even though the Bible clearly allows Christians to eat every type of food, nevertheless believes that he cannot eat certain kinds of foods. It just bothers him. He may be of a Jewish background and still is bound by the Jewish dietary code. And so even though he may know theoretically it's all right to eat pork, he just can't do it. His conscience just is not going to allow it. He's troubled by it. Well, so he's the strict believer, overly strict. And verse 3 says, let not him who eats despise him who does not eat, and let not him who does not eat judge him who eats, for God has received him. So there is some very clear advice here for both categories of believers. Watch out how you relate yourself to those in the opposite category. Watch out for your attitudes towards those in the opposite category. God's will is that both categories be able to live together in unity and harmony and Christian fellowship and love. But if you don't have the right attitude, that's going to be very difficult. On the broadcast yesterday and the day before, I gave you some practical advice for the non-strict believer. And I started on the broadcast yesterday to give some practical advice for the strict believer. And we're going to continue that today. I pointed out, and I do this by way of review, that the strict believer actually has some commendable strengths. The strength of commitment, the strength of self-discipline, the strength of self-denial, willing to deny himself for the cause of Christ. the strength of a strong desire to please the Lord, to perform well as a good soldier of Jesus Christ, and doesn't mind if he has to restrict his freedom somewhat in order to accomplish that. He's perfectly willing to do that, whereas sometimes a non-strict believer is unwilling to make any sacrifices. So this is a commendable attitude that the strict believer often has. But there are some weaknesses, and let's discuss them. It's important to understand them. What are they? Number one weakness is often that the strict believer believes that his non-essential scruples are, in fact, essential. Now, I've just introduced another word that I don't think I've used before, and that's the term scruple. That his non-essential scruples, that his non-essential rules that he lives by, that are stricter than the Bible requires, it is often that strict believers are convinced that those non-essential restrictions are essential. That God does require them. That the Bible does require them. That's a weakness, to not know where the boundary lines actually are. Strict believers are often convinced that their particular restriction is biblically required. They're certain of that. And they want to defend that against all who would say otherwise. And this is why it's so difficult many times for these two categories of believers to fellowship together. Because the strict believer often is convinced that the non-strict believer is sinning, when all he's doing is exercising legitimate biblical liberty. But the strict believer is convinced that he's sinning because he allows himself to do things that the strict believer would not allow himself to do, and which the strict believer thinks are biblically required. I could give you a lot of different examples here. And I know that as soon as I do, then I risk offending people rather than just dealing with generalities and hoping that the Holy Spirit will show you what needs to be understood and applied in your particular situation. But I know godly women who've grown up in certain Christian traditions who refuse to cut their hair at all. I know some that have gone through their whole life and have never cut their hair. Now, because their hair is long and unwieldy, they don't wear it long. They wrap it up around their head so that it becomes quite a collection of hair on the top of their head. But nevertheless, it is long, because the Bible does have some things to say about the distinction between male and female, and women having long hair and their hair being their glory. So, in typical Christian fashion, as we see so often in so many areas, and in among born-again believers who are beloved Christians, and lovely Christians, and committed Christians, but as so often happens, we will go a step or two beyond what the Bible requires. The Bible talks about women having long hair, basically, longer than men. That's the idea. As a distinction between male and female, women have longer hair than men. That's the distinction. That's the comparison. The Bible doesn't say how long. The Bible doesn't say that a woman may never cut her hair. But in typical fashion, traditional fashion that so often happens, we tend to go a step or two beyond what the Bible requires. The Bible commends long hair. We're going to have long, long hair. The Bible commends long hair. We're going to say that it's wrong to cut your hair at all, ever. And what almost always happens is that those who believe and practice that somewhere along the way get the idea that that is what the Bible requires. And then they begin to become judgmental toward those Christian ladies who cut their hair. They tend to be judgmental. They treat their particular regulation, their rule, their restriction as a requirement. And anyone who violates their requirement sins. I'll give you another one. By way of practical example, let's take the contents of the cup in the Lord's table. What should be in that cup? Grape juice or wine? Well, I'm going to have an argument on my hands no matter what I say here, but let's agree that it is likely, almost certain, that the contents of the cup on the table when Jesus instituted the Lord's table was wine, alcoholic wine. Now, there are some who will dispute that, but I think that scholarship has demonstrated that that is almost certainly so. All right, what are we to make of that? Well, you have Christians who feel strongly on both sides of this issue. Believe you me, I have known Christians who would not partake of the Lord's table because the content was grape juice, and they had a troubled conscience unless they had wine like my Lord had, like the Lord used when he instituted the Lord's Supper. I must have it that way. It was wine, alcoholic wine. And there are other Christians who feel just as strongly that they could never allow alcoholic wine to touch their lips for any reason, even if the contents of the original communion cup were wine. I'm not going to touch wine. I couldn't partake if there were wine in there. It has to be grape juice. Now, let's be honest to recognize that grape juice is a modern invention. Welch, the man who invented grape juice, and it was a man named Welch back in the 1800s in America, who first came up with the process by which he could bottle grape juice, bottle the juice of the grape, and keep it from fermenting and keep it fresh so that grape juice would be available as a regular beverage. And by the way, I love it, and I keep it in my refrigerator at home, and I drink a glass of grape juice most every night before I go to bed. Grape juice, not wine. But it's not because I think the Bible forbids wine. I have other reasons for doing so. But back to the communion cup controversy. The reason that Welch did that, I'm told, is because as a Christian, he was a strong advocate of what was called temperance, but what was really abstinence. In other words, he was part of the movement that was trying to get people to commit themselves to not drink alcohol in any form, in any amount. And he recognized that he could never make much progress in this as long as Christians were partaking of alcoholic wine in the communion service, which at that particular time, all Christians did. It virtually was universal because it was the only thing available. Unless they happened to get the fresh juice of the grapes just immediately at the time of harvest, but otherwise it was always alcoholic wine. So he came up with a process to bottle and preserve grape juice, and that became the most common contents of the cup in America and has been now for more than 150 years, but it didn't used to be that way. Now, isn't it amazing how we could go back and forth on something like this? And there are one set of Christians who would not allow themselves to drink anything but grape juice, even though it's pretty obvious that's not what Christ had. And others who would not allow themselves to have, which one are we talking about now? Non-alcoholic wine, would not allow themselves to have grape juice because Christ obviously did have grape wine. And on it goes. Well, we'll have to take it up next week. I hope you'll join me. Until then, good day. May God give you his eternal peace.